It's now the 10th of December, and I'm continuing the interview with Stephen Mills. Stephen, last time when we left it, you were talking about you going overseas to study at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and doing the course of Master of Public Administration. Was that part of an overall plan of yours for further your education or your career?
Well, it was certainly a continuation of it, and it seemed to be the really good opportunity given where I was at the time. It was I'd won a fellowship, a Harkness Fellowship, through the Commonwealth Fund of New York. Wonderful fellowship where you had to put together a program for study and travel, not just study. So it wasn't an academic fellowship as such. So I put together a proposal for doing the 12-month mid-career MPA at the Kennedy School. And because it was 1984, tying that in with the program of travel, they wanted you to travel and see the United States. And I thought, what better way of doing that than traveling in the presidential election primaries, which were on at that time. So that proposal was accepted and I went off. My wife also, Helen, applied separately under her own steam to get into the Kennedy School, and she was also accepted, so we were both there as students. The course, I guess, goes from, it was a 12-month thing from mid-83, so we had been here for the Hawke government and for the election of the Hawke government and for the summit and for the dams decision in the High Court, the Franklin Dam decision, and then we left probably, I don't know, June. Had a fantastic farewell party that Heather Ewart and Simon Nash hosted for us, where the cocktails were literally served in, made up in large plastic rubbish bins, clean, new plastic rubbish bins, I emphasise. It was a memorable event for many reasons, and many people might remember it. We went off, lived in Boston for 12 months. The course was absolutely outstanding. The travel was very successful. I travelled, it was a Democratic primary year because Reagan was president, and there was a pretty interesting field of Democratic, Gary Hart, Walter Mondale, Jesse Jackson. I went up to New Hampshire a lot because that's very adjacent to Boston. On one occasion went down to Georgia with Jesse Jackson, which was just an absolutely magnificent experience. I attended the two conventions in San Francisco and Dallas. I attended all of the Reagan-Mondale debates and the vice presidential debate, and it was just a fantastic exposure to American politics. I kind of stretched my course out a little bit over 18 months, actually over 2 years, but 18 months of study, and managed also to... We lived in Washington for 6 months at the second half of... 84, and while I was in Washington, I started really getting interested in election campaign. I started getting interested in the way in which ideas are presented in election campaigns. I had this idea of a book on what I was thinking, Issues and Images, which is a very clunky title, but that's what it was about. And I started interviewing, I managed to get to do some interviews just as a student, not as a journalist, with some of the American political consultants there. I had a great interview with Richard Werthlin, who was Reagan's pollster, with a couple of the big Democratic consultants, Bob Squire in Washington and Joe Napolitano up in Massachusetts, and a couple of other people, Kathleen Frankovic, who was at one of the big TV stations running their polling organisation. And I really started getting interested in not just election campaigns, and I suppose moving away from the issues or the policy component of it and getting into the technology of campaigning, in particular the relationship between market research, which the Americans did spectacularly well, and television advertising, which they also did very well. And it gave me an idea for a book, and when I came back from the States in mid-84, I actually begged my editor, Creighton Burns, for another 6 months' extension leave of absence so that I could write, so that I could do some Australian interviews similar to what I'd done in the States, and ended up writing this book, The New Machine Men, which came out in 1986, and it was about basically the intersection of market research and television advertising. So that was, so to answer your question, it was certainly a career expansion. I felt as though I needed a change from the gallery, and this was and needed to, you know, retool intellectually, which the Kennedy School provides a great exposure to contemporary public administration policy. And also, as I say, it kind of unexpectedly led to this research interest, which led to the book.
With your background, both in the press gallery and having worked for the student newspapers as well, and your own interest in Labour politics, did you ever look at the, at this point in time, look at the possibility of going into a career in politics yourself?
Well, yes, but I always decided I wouldn't. I just didn't think I'd be any good at it. I decided years earlier when I was at uni, which would have been the obvious time to join the Labour Party if I was going to, that I didn't, you know, in the full flush of my, 20-year-old, you know, strong-headed arrogance, that I didn't feel comfortable joining and being confined within the policy constraints of a political party. I felt that was too, you know, confining. But also I don't think I had... I believe I did not and do not have the skills requisite to be an elected politician. And on the other hand, I love being a journalist. I just thought being a journalist was a fabulous way of getting into politics. And the same applies for later on when I became a political staffer. You get this incredibly close-up, intimate perspective on national politics of the most profound import, and you're there as a, not just as a spectator, but as a participant, as a journalist, with a job of explaining, well, understanding it and explaining it to people, you know, voters, people out there in the community who wouldn't know it otherwise. And I thought this was a, I thought being a journalist, being a political reporter, was a extremely valuable and, I mean, can I say honourable way of contributing to national political life. You know, I had in mind the reader of the age and I tried to write for them and explain things to them, you know, from what I recognised was this amazingly privileged position of sitting up in the press gallery, having exposure to all of these events and issues just taking place around you. So, again, I guess a long answer to the question, but I really felt as though journalism was a marvellous way of getting exposure to politics and without the risk, complexity, and I just thought inappropriateness of me being a, you know, trying to make a political career.
So with this new background and you, and the training and exposure you had in the United States, how did you end up working for the Prime Minister as a speechwriter?
Well, it certainly was not on the face of it. You would say, you know, this is impossible because I'd had no speechwriting experience. Well, this is Australia. It was, it's a small country. You know, I knew a bloke who knew a bloke, you know. No, what happened was that I had... well, when I published The New Machine Men, that came out in 86, and at that point I'd returned to The Age after my extended leave of absence. I was reporting out of Melbourne and kind of, look, it was a bit like, how do you keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? You know, I mean, I'd been at Harvard, I'd been watching a presidential election campaign, and then I felt coming back to Melbourne was just very tedious, and I recognise the generosity of the Age organisation in having granted me this huge leeway. And then when I came back, I just didn't feel as though I could give it my all. Plus, my wife Helen was appointed with the ABC to a position in Sydney, and so then I asked Creighton, would he send me to the Sydney Bureau of the Age, and he agreed. And I must say, from my point of view, journalistically, Sydney was even drier than Melbourne. I didn't have a great... I mean, it was quite interesting working in the Herald building and so forth, but there's just not a lot of news up there for the Age. So I was ripe for when the phone rang, and the phone rang from Jeff Walsh. Jeff, whom I'd known as a journo at the Age. Jeff started out as a journalist with the Albury Border Mail. Worked for the, I think it worked for the Fin Review, certainly worked for the Age at that stage, and I'd got to know him then. But had since had gone on to join the ALP as a National Communications Director, and then he was on Bob Hawke's staff as Hawke's first press secretary. I got a call from Jeff saying, you know, would I be interested in coming to write speeches for Hawkey? My first thought was, oh my God, how ridiculous, but I was just immediately attracted to the idea and found it irresistible, and said yes.
And this inspired you obviously, you felt that your background was right for the job, notwithstanding the fact that you as you said, how come I accepted this challenge?
Well, to be a Hawke's speechwriter, I wouldn't say this as a general point, but to be Hawke's speechwriter, speech writing experience was not necessary, and I'd better explain that paradox before, you know. But so I had no speech writing experience, but I could obviously write. I had a lot of experience writing journalism. I'd just written a book. I was obviously up to speed with contemporary politics and public administration. I had no background in anything. I'd never really come across Hawke. I'll explain this, but I had no background in areas that had been of interest to him, namely economics and industrial relations. I'll say possibly my most embarrassing moment of my life was, and I checked the dating of this in preparation for this interview, 1986, it was in February, I believe, when I was still at the Age, working out of the Melbourne office, and I'd been sent down to Tasmania to cover one of the logging disputes at Farmhouse Creek. And while I was there, Hawke was coming through Launceston, and I forget why, but they said, can you go up to Launceston, and he's making an announcement or doing a press conference or something like that. And so I went to the press conference, and I'm pretty sure that was the first time I'd seen Hawke in a journalistic capacity. Obviously seen him as a public figure, but being in the same room with him as a journalist. And there was some dispute going on at the time in the Labor Party between Hawke and Bill Hartley in the Victorian Labor Party. And I asked a question about that. And in the process of asking the question, you know, in this, you've got to get your words in pretty quick when you're asking press conferences, you're competing with other journalists and so forth. And I confused the names. I referred to Hawkley, a combination of Hawke and Hartley, to massive hilarity by everybody else, including Hawke, and immense humiliation for me. I just couldn't believe that I'd said it, but there it was. So, stumbling question. Anyway, so, you know, I mean, I think, as I say, looking at me, you wouldn't say, God, there's Bob Hawke's future speechwriter.
Did he interview you?
Yes. What? Yeah, so
he personally interviewed you.
Yeah, so Jeff got me to come up to Canberra. I can remember the interview very clearly in the Prime Minister's office in the old Parliament House. There were these, I was very nervous. There were these armchairs, which I see they still have their little seats with arms that fit into wooden arms that fit into sockets of the legs. And I, during this interview, I was gripping the arms so tightly that I actually pulled the arm of the armchair out of its socket slightly. So that's how nervous I was. But Hawke was, it was just such a hilarious interview. No, I shouldn't say hilarious. It was a very friendly interview. Hawke looked at my CV. He noted that I'd studied Greek history and said, you should have worked for Gough, not me. Which was very good. He offered me the job. He said, fine. I mean, it wasn't even he was obviously checking me out. He found me satisfactory, and so I started. I think they wanted somebody who was a straight up and down political communicator. I've always said of Hawke's speeches, shall I go on with this now? I mean, because I think it was relevant right from the start. It was a lot of the American tradition of speech writing is almost poetic. You know, Peggy Noonan wrote for Reagan speeches that were like when the Challenger space shuttle exploded, which were almost poetic. And there's a long tradition of American high rhetoric. They expect their political leaders to produce it. Now, Australia, thank God, has never gone down that path. We are much more prosaic, literally that word. And Hawke in particular. Hawke was not into poetry, he was into prose. You know, he was into argument. And his whole background as an advocate in the Arbitration Commission had been arguing cases. So he didn't want some high-flowing, florid, poetical speech. He wanted somebody who could make an argument, and I was the right one for that, for sure. I could write clear English. I could marshal an argument. I could present the evidence and the stats, which he always wanted, the factual basis for the evidence, and I could put that in an appropriate advocacy mode. He was always trying to persuade his audiences, not necessarily inspire or mobilize but persuade them. And I could obviously with a lot of input and assistance and so forth, but I could formulate those persuasive arguments.
Mm. In a formal sense, what were your duties when you were appointed? What did you assume were your duties?
It was only speech writing. Preparing at different levels of formality, depending on the event that he was speaking at, but preparing speaking notes or speeches for all of his public appearances. It was not attached to the press office. It was an advisor role in the, you know, in the office. So my title was advisor.
How did that operation work? I mean, there was a second speechwriter, I believe, most of the time there, was there not?
They had already, I was the, if you like, the second. Graham Freudenberg was already in place. Graham obviously had a long and good relationship with Hawke. He tells the story of having been at some point, it's in his book, so I won't try and tell it for him, but I mean, at some point between the fall of the Whitlam government and when Hawke became opposition leader, there'd been some famous dinner of staff and MPs and so forth, and Hawkey apparently said to Graham, you know, when I become Prime Minister, will you become my speechwriter? And so when Hawke did become Prime Minister, he picked up the phone and asked Graham and referred back to that event and so forth. So, and I mean, Graham was a person of just profound political experience in government. Obviously going back to Whitlam, but had previously worked under Cornwall. But significantly, I say in government, because his big experience was in was with Whitlam and then with Neville Wran. Now, I'm probably a bit foggy on the details, but I believe that in 1983 he was still working kind of part-time with Neville and part-time with Hawke. And the brief, as I understand it, was that Graham would do the quote-unquote the big speeches. But there were two problems with that. One is, I think Hawke was just an engine, you know, for speech making. Hawke was a prolific public speaker, and you know, the output was just too great for one person to write speeches for. And also, I mean, I believe one of the reasons I was approached and invited to join the office was because there was probably something of a mismatch between Graham's more elevated style and Hawke's more deliberate and argumentative style. And I think if you look back, there was a federal ALP conference in 1986 where there'd been some issues about Hawke's speech, and I'd been approached after that. So in a sense, Graham was certainly already there and had and continued to have a very important role in writing speeches. But
so who determined who would write which speech? And was that Hawke himself who said, who gave you the jobs? Or how were they selected and given to Graham and the rest to you, so to speak?
There was no written document or anything like that that spelled these out, and it certainly wasn't Bob, whose job was to govern the country, you know, and not resolve these issues. Look, we just developed an understanding, but it was never clear, and in fact, I mean, it's well known that at the start of our relationship there was a fair bit of tempest and turmoil as we sorted out these issues. Graham, with his great good sense, has referred to it as the old bull and the young bull in the same paddock together, and there certainly was a bit of clashing of horns. I mean, I felt I was there to do a job, and I felt I was there, I guess, to ensure that speech writing was on track and was efficient. So I recall with some qualms, but I would endeavour to edit Graham, which he didn't like, which he took exception to. And we did have I think there was only one, but it certainly sticks in my memory, we had a shouting match, which led to some to a door being slammed. And I think much amusement and astonishment on the behalf of the rest of the staff who could not work out what this was about. But it was quite important for us as we sorted out our working relationship.
So there wasn't a time, I'm just curious, there might have been occasions where in the early days then that you both might be writing the same speech? Or find that you had all both started
Look,
working
that,
on
that? Look, that continued, and I'll tell you later, that did continue to be an issue throughout. But I mean, let me, you know, I don't want to over-dramatise this. For the bulk, it was pretty obvious. I mean, if Hawke is going to address the, I don't know, some industry association, the AMW, I mean, is the what was it called, the manufacturing, I've forgotten the title, it went on to become the Industries Australia. Anyway, he would, you know, they would have their annual meeting in Canberra, manufacturing industry, or there'd be some Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, or, you know, ACOS, or whatever it was. It was pretty obvious what the Prime Minister would be saying in that event. It would be pretty obvious what the government's and the Prime Minister's key messages are to such groups. And indeed, it's the messages were consistent, obviously, regardless of the audience, about stable economic management, about the transition from the failures of the Fraser government to the successes of the Hawke government, about the requirement for restraint, about the benefits of the accord, you know, about the strength of the education and policies. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty obvious. You didn't have to be Bertrand Russell to sort out, you know, what the basic message were going to be. And for the vast majority of those, that was my territory. They were the, you know, common or garden speech. Similarly, Hawke goes on an electorate visit to the, you know, some electorate in Adelaide or Perth and so forth. And on one day, he'll make five speeches. You know, there'll be a Labor Party barbecue. There'll be a meeting with the town council. There'll be the opening of some school wing or old folks home or something like that. And again, you know, they're pretty stock standard. They're not particularly exciting things. We didn't do those as full speeches. I did them as speaking notes. And again, pretty obvious who's going to do those. That was me. So when I say big speeches, you know, the policy speech, and we always had issues about that. The big international numbers. But, you know, in a sense, that's not surprising, because the bigger the speech, the greater its import, and the more, if you like, stakeholders are interested in it and want to have a view in it. And, you know, perhaps also the greater the focus on it, so more hands to the pump. So, you know, we actually got a very good working relationship out of it, and I'm happy with that, and I know Graham's happy with that. We ended up having, whilst the issues were never resolved, you know, they're not in political offices, but we had at the end a brilliant working relationship, actually, and a very constructive one. Very good one.
I'm interested in the I suppose they call them the mechanics. Someone would have told you that Prime Minister is going to, and obviously you're going to visit X, Y, and Z places, sure, and need speeches. So there must be someone who briefed you and or Graham that, yeah, this is what's coming up, and you guys do something there.
Sure. Okay. So there was always an advance program, and that document was. Belonged to Jill Saunders, who was the appointment secretary. And, you know, it's always true in political offices, you know, the person who holds the diary, very important office. Jill, immensely capable woman, and still working for Hawke, you know, now to this day, as his kind of chief organiser. So she would have a forward program, and that forward program was obviously, you know, heavily contested. You know, there would be, how do you fit in an international visit? The political advisor would, you know, want something. There's an ALP federal conference. There's a WA state Labor Party conference. There's visiting heads of government. You know, so, I mean, it is a traffic jam. Jill did a brilliant job in managing that whole process. You know, but through a combination of internal office processes, we would know that, okay, December the 5th, it's the AGM, it's the, you know, federal conference of this, Hawke is going to be the keynote speaker, we need to do it. Or March the 27th, he's making an electorate visit to WA. So you would know that. And then, you know, the details gradually, you know, coalesce of electorate visits. He's got to do this. The local member is suggesting something. And so it was a bit of a rolling feast, but I was involved. So we would have diary sessions. I would always attend those with Jill and usually the political advisor and the press office and so forth. So we would have those discussions. And obviously, as the event got closer, there were details would crystallise. So the actual speech writing process?
Well, there was just these, Would you be the one to say, sir, look for material, or would that be fed to you by, say, political advisor and prime minister and others?
No, at this stage that I'm talking about, really, the PM's not involved. I mean, there's a lot of staff work that goes to it. I'm not saying he's not aware of the overall shape. Of course he is, but in terms of the specifics. But typically what would happen would be that the speech writing process would get underway without him having to be involved. The speech writing process would typically begin with me or Jill or, you know, the office advising the department, advising the Prime Minister, Cabinet Department, of this forthcoming event and commissioning a draft. So there was possibly the worst job in the world. Somebody over in the department had to think of, you know, the absolutely basic raw materials for the speech, and that would come over to me as a draft. We called it and used it as a chopping block, but it was something. Now, obviously, that didn't cover party political speeches. With those, they were entirely generated internally, but for the most of them, there was always a degree of, you know, factual policy input, which I would then start with, and I would develop a draft on that basis. And I say typically, there were many exceptions, but typically I wouldn't present that draft to the Prime Minister until maybe a week out from the event or something like that. He would look at a draft, he would make some suggestions, and then, you know, the final thing would be done with that. I have to say, I mean, the whole point of being a speechwriter for a Prime Minister is that the Prime Minister has just got so much on his bloody plate, he simply can't write his own speeches. Now, Hawke was an extremely capable speechwriter. He could have done everything if he wanted to, but you just can't. So the job of being a speechwriter is, I always used to say, is I have to draft the kind of speech that Hawke himself would draft if he had time. But he doesn't have time, so I have to be good enough to think my way into his mind and his style and the political character of the government at the time to do a draft which was hopefully as close as possible, and sometimes quite close and sometimes not so close, and he would have to, you know, come in and you know, write bits over the top.
When you were writing a draft, would you show with other people in the office, would they be given those drafts for comment?
Yep. So
then back to you for further work?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So if it's an economic speech, it would certainly go to the economic advisors. Foreign policy speeches to the foreign advisor. You know, if the press office would have a look at it. So yes, absolutely, a very collaborative process. It was I have to say, it was, I mean, it was the best job I've ever had, this job. The team spirit in it, the collegial team spirit, was fantastic. You know, you're dealing with people who are experts, deeply informed public servants and political advisors who are just focused on Hawke's effectiveness. And it was a great experience. So yes, great collaboration. You know, great collaboration.
Did you and Graham collaborate on speeches at occasionally?
Yes. Oh yes. Yes. He you know, sometimes, gosh, I'm trying to think for specific examples, but you know, he was very good at the party political language, and as I say, the somewhat more elevated language. And sometimes our speeches would, you know, would combine. He wouldn't want to be across the nitty-gritty, and you know, but he could certainly provide some appropriate framing, political framing, you know, for a speech.
Well, and going back to looking a bit more about your collaboration with Graham, you shared an office in here in Old Parliament House at that time. And what office was that? Is that the one that's currently marked as you were at the speechwriter's office in the old Parliament House?
Or is it the
one next door?
It's the one next door. And I've...
How did that come about? Is that, do you know why they've selected the other one to be
there? I've got no idea. The one they've selected was Craig Emerson's office. Look, I just think it's a, you know, they just made a mistake. I've pointed out to them and I hope it will be changed. No, Graham and I shared the office, which was a lot smaller than the one they've indicated. it was the little corridor, if you like. It has two doors and two desks. Its space was further reduced by there being this gigantic filing cabinet safe with a numbered kind of lock on the thing, which God knows what that was doing there. We never used it, but it was cramped conditions. I mean, this space that we're in here, Edward, at the end of this room is about the full size of it, and I'm, you know, not counting the jolly filing cabinet, you know. So it was pretty tiny. Graham is not a desk man, so we were not there, you know, side by side very often. I mean, Graham was commuting down from Sydney frequently, so, you know, there were periods of time when I had that full expanse of that office to myself. But yeah, that was a speechwriter's office.
The story goes around that, in fact, at some time you had to divide your time in the office there, so one worked during the night and the other one worked during the day.
Yeah, that was Graham. Well, Graham was much more.